a la selección china de personas que presentan al mundo la antorcha olímpica se ha transformado en una lección de derechos humanos para la Unión Americana. Beatriz Salas amplía la información.
Decidir sobre quiénes serán los portadores de la antorcha en la ceremonia inaugural de los Juegos Olímpicos de Invierno en Pekín es la responsabilidad de China, y Estados Unidos no está en posición de hacer comentarios despectivos. Así respondió Pekín a la reciente interferencia de Washington, quien aseveró que la elección de China del atleta de la etnia Uyghur de Nijir Dilamujian para llevar la antorcha olímpica es un esfuerzo de Pekín para distraer la atención del llamado genocidio en la región de Xinjiang.
Los llamados comentarios de genocidio de Estados Unidos son la gran mentira del siglo y exponen su intento de politizar los Juegos Olímpicos de Invierno y su siniestra intención de utilizar el tema relacionado con Xinjiang para difamar a China.
China asimismo acusó a Estados Unidos de mentir de manera descarada sobre las minorías étnicas, mientras olvida sistemáticamente discriminaciones en su propio suelo.
Estados Unidos llevó a cabo un genocidio contra los nativos americanos en el pasado y ha discriminado sistemáticamente a las minorías raciales a largo plazo. La población de nativos americanos se ha desplomado de 5 millones a finales del siglo XV a unos 250 mil a principios del siglo XX, reduciéndose a una vigésima parte. ¿Qué es el genocidio? Las políticas que Estados Unidos ha impuesto a los nativos americanos son un verdadero genocidio.
Zhao, además de criticar la discriminación racial contra los africanos y asiáticos en Estados Unidos, dijo que elegir a un atleta de la etnia Uyghur muestra que la política de China de promover los deportes de invierno y mejorar la salud de las personas está beneficiando a individuos de todos los grupos étnicos y prueba que no existe discriminación.
Lo que Estados Unidos debería estar haciendo es revisar cuidadosamente sus propios crímenes históricos contra los nativos americanos y tomar medidas concretas para reducir la discriminación racial contra estas personas y otras minorías raciales, como los africanos y asiáticos.
China, en reiteradas ocasiones, ha instado a Estados Unidos a dejar de usar los asuntos vinculados con Xinjiang para difundir mentiras, interferir en los asuntos internos de China o intentar detener el desarrollo del país. Advierte que, de lo contrario, Pekín dará una respuesta más contundente a la luz del desarrollo de la situación. Beatriz Salas, con información de Niloufar Shakuri, Hispan TV Noticias.
Migrantes de todos los rincones del mundo duermen bajo su mismo cielo estrellado. Me los encuentro en las calles, en los cines, en los supermercados, y el olor de sus comidas me embriaga de placer. Todos ellos son mis vecinos.
Y yo aquí vivo, bajo sus leyes domésticas, pago impuestos y mis manos producen la riqueza nacional.
Soy parte de esa comunidad que vive, trabaja y sueña con una mañana mejor para nuestras familias.
Casi todos migrantes como yo, casi todos soñadores como yo.
Trabajemos pues en la construcción de otra nación que nos haga dignos.
Seamos los arquitectos de nuestro sueño colectivo.
Esta radio no tiene comerciales porque tú nos apoyas. Si ya has hecho una aportación económica, te damos las gracias. Si no, hazlo ahora en kpfk.org o llama al 818-985-5735.
Así llegamos al final de esta edición del Informativo Pacífica. Nuestro más profundo agradecimiento a todos los medios y personas que hicieron posible este programa. A nombre de Norma Martínez, se despide tu amigo de siempre, Fernando Velázquez. Gracias por acompañarnos.
Este y otros programas del Informativo Pacífica pueden ser escuchados o descargados en iPod o en forma tradicional en www.kpfk.org en los archivos de audio.
Told me, you know, we'll give you a day, we'll give you a week, however long it takes for you to accept our help to be healed and to become a child of God and denounce being gay.
Honoring the memory of Dr. Anonymous, coming up on the Rainbow Minute.
got three quarters of the way through several times and was like, well, I have no idea how this would end, so I have to start over. But one thing I know is I can't end a story without hope.
Welcome to This Way Out, the international LGBTQ radio magazine. I'm Lucia Chappell. Nicaragua's NGO Purge targets its oldest queer group. Gay Taiwanese movie sings out a universal love song and upending the artistic process with Amanda Kayback. All that and more this week because you've discovered This Way Out.
I'm Joe Bainline.
And I'm John Dyer V.
With NewsWrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting LGBTQ communities around the world for the week ending August 28, 2021. The government of Nicaragua is aiming to shut down the country's oldest LGBTQ advocacy group. The Interior Ministry has asked the National Assembly to annul the legal nonprofit status of Fundación Xaquiquetzal and 14 other non-governmental organizations. President.
Culture. They sounds of oppression against the white man's game he's run on us all these blue years. Blues is struggle, strangulation of our people, cause we couldn't off the white mother socking it to us. But now, when I hear Billy's soft, soulful sighs of Am I Blue, I say, no, sweet Billy, no mo'. No mo' blue trains running on this track, they all been derailed. Am I Blue, sweet Baby Blue, Billy, no, I'm black and ready.
Blue Preachers come out every night. I try to tell you what's wrong and what's right. But when asked about something to eat, they will answer in voices so sweet. You will eat by and by in that glorious land in the sky. Play a pie, work and pray, live on hay. You'll get by in the sky when you die. That's the lie the starvation army they play. And they shout and they clap and they pray. When they got all your coins on the drum, they will tell you when you're on the bum. You will eat by and by in that glorious land in the sky. Way up high, work and pray, live on hay. You'll get by in the sky when you die. That's the lie. Holy rollers and jumpers come out, and they roll and they jump and they shout. Now give your money to Jesus, they say, and you'll eat on that glorious day. You will eat by and by in that glorious land in the sky. Way up high, work and pray, live on hay. You'll get by in the sky when you die. That's why working folks of all countries unite. Side by side, we for freedom will fight. When this world and its wealth we have gained, to the grandeurs we'll sing this refrain. You will eat by and by, when you learn how to cook and how to fry. Chop some wood, do you good, and you'll eat in that sweet by and by.
My weapon jammed and I got stuck way out and all alone. And I could hear the enemy moving in close outside. Just then I heard a twig snap and I grabbed my empty gun. And I dug in scared while I counted down my fate. And then a big marine, a giant with a pair of friendly eyes, appeared there at my shoulder and said, wait. When he came in close beside me, he said, don't worry, son, I'm here. If Charlie wants to tangle now, he'll have two to dodge. I said, well, thanks a lot. I told him my name and asked him his. And he said, the boys just call me Camouflage. Side by side we took our battle stance, and I wondered how the bullets missed this man. Cause they seemed to go right through him, just as if he wasn't there. And the morning we both took a chance and ran. And it was near the riverbank when the ambush came on top of us. And I thought it was the end that we were had. Then a bullet with my name on it came buzzing through a bush. And that big marine, you just swatted with
saved me from the jungle and then was gone. And when I got back to my HQ, I told them about my night and the battle I'd spent with a big Marine named Camouflage. When I said his name, the soldier gulped and a medic took my arm and led me to a green tent on the right. He said, you may be telling true, boy, but this here is Camouflage. And he's been right here since he passed away last night. In fact, he's been here all week long. But before he went, he said, Semper Fi, and said his only wish was to save a young Marine caught in a barrage. So here, take his dog tag, son. I know he wants you to have it now. And we both said a prayer for a big Marine named Camouflage. Whoa, Camouflage. Things are never quite the way.
Christ was a man that traveled through the land, hard-working man and brave. He said to the rich, give your goods to the poor, so they laid Jesus Christ in his grave. Yes, Jesus was a man, a carpenter by hand, his followers true and brave. One dirty coward called Judas Iscariot has laid poor Jesus in his grave. He went to the preacher, he went to the sheriff, told them all the same. Sell all of your jewelry and give it to the poor, so they laid Jesus Christ in his grave. When Jesus come to town, the working folks around believed what he did say. The bankers and the preachers, they nailed him on a cross and they laid Jesus Christ in his grave. Now the working people followed him around, sang and shouted gay. But the cops and soldiers nailed him in the air, and they laid Jesus Christ in his grave. Well, the people held their breath when they heard about his death. Everybody wondered why. It was the landlord and the soldiers that he hired to nail Jesus Christ in the sky. This song was made in New York City of a rich man's and preachers and slaves. If Jesus was to preach like he preached in Galilee, they would lay Jesus Christ in his grave. Yes, Jesus was a man and a carpenter by hand, his followers true and brave. One dirty coward called Judas Iscariot has laid poor Jesus in his grave.
can't face your party. They will think you this for me. Give me good, good news. Give me good, good news. You can't stare in the face of party. They will think you this for me.
Turned on my radio, spun the dial, thought I'd listen to some news for a while. I grabbed the knob, spun it around, got NPR. Here's what I found. Real news? Hardly a trace, just one damn marathon marketplace. The Nasdaq's up, the Dow's in the cellar, and NPR sold out to Rockefeller. Hostile takeover. Real hostile. Well, I hear about all the antitrust and all the day traders who bit the dust. Mergers, buyouts, and acquisitions. Low-down crooks in high positions. Wheelers, dealers, and CEOs fired and paid off through the nose. Buying yachts and fancy homes with the bailout money from the savings and loans. And I get pissed off, that is. It's dot-com this and dot-com that. The underwriters are getting fat on airwaves sold from you and me by a bunch of thieves called the FCC. They don't give a damn what we want and need. They've all caved into corporate greed and sold us out to the ruling class. Well, the whole damn bunch can hit kiss my dot-com. This is a family show, folks. FCC says watch your language. English. What's yours? I got tired of being treated like a veg, so I called up the station and canceled my pledge. In a mighty act of liberation, sent the money off to my community station. I said, I love you, but if you blow it, I'll sure as hell let you know it. I'll knock the radio off the shelf, buy a transmitter, and do it myself. Whitebeard the Pirate. This is radio station HOBO, broadcasting on a vagrancy of 60 to 90 days, signing off for now.
ashes of blood march the civilized soldier over the ruins of the French fortress of a failure, over the silent screams of the dead and the dying. But please be reassured, we seek no outer war. The treaties were signed, the country was split into sections. But growing numbers of prisons were built for protection, rapidly filling with people who called for election. But please be reassured, we seek no outer war. The golden DM was the puppet who danced for the power. The hero of hate who gambled on hell for his hour. Father of his country was stamped on the medals we shower. But please be reassured, we seek no outer war. Machine gun bullets became the bloody baptizer. And the falcon copters don't care if someone's the wiser. But the boy in the swamp didn't.
And coming up next on the stream of free radio at freakradio.net, it's Bathrop Spears Broadsides, the May 20th, 2022 show. Going to have, mainly two big things. One is an interview with Andrea Henson, who is a Where Do We Go Berkeley activist and attorney, who I interviewed a week ago and then failed to play the interview. My apologies, Andrea. And I'm going to try to reach her again for a follow-up interview for the Sunday show. No time for it on this particular show coming up here on the 12th. Then there's going to be a lengthy interview with Keith McHenry of Food Not Bombs on a number of subjects. Sometimes I think we've had too much of him, but I'm kind of got some interesting questions I asked him and got some interesting answers. And Keith always seems to be not only to some extent with his feet on the ground and his fingers to the pulse of things, and he's very candid. I don't follow him around, so I can't vouch for the truth of his statements, but I feel like he has he's determined to give the details of his own experiences and his own conversations, and as well as his own thoughts and conclusions. So you be the judge. Check him out. He's coming at you, and here we go.
I'm tired of moon songs, of star and of June songs. They simply make me nap. And ditties romantic drive me nearly frantic. I think they're all full of pap. History's making, nations are quaking. Why sing of stars above? For while we are waiting, Father Time's creating new things to be singing of. Sing me a song with social significance. All other tunes are taboo. I want a ditty with heat in it, appealing with feeling and meat in it. Sing me a song with social significance, or you can sing till you're blue. Let meaning shine from every line, or I won't love you.
And we're going to kick this off with an interview, as I said before, with Andrea Henson. And I don't think there's too much to be said about this. If you want to go to Where Do We Go Berkeley, I haven't been able to find anything truly new, but there is the lawsuit that was filed against Caltrans, the struggle and the ultimate overturning of the protection of the where do we go encampment from the Caltrans authorities. But Andrea Henson gives a pretty good analysis of it, and I don't know, I haven't heard, that much may have changed in the last week, but I haven't heard about it one way or the other, and I will try to keep you updated when I do, assuming I continue to do these netcasts, which, who knows, never can tell. So, here we go. So, today is the 5th of May, and it's about 3 o'clock. I'm on the line with Andrea Henson, who's an activist and also a civil rights attorney. I'm not going to hold your attorney status against you, Andrea.
Thank you.
Yes, but the fact that you're an activist gets especially high marks in my book. You're actually talking to me from your campsite, which is, where are you located anyway?
I'm at 2nd and Page in Berkeley, California.
Where is that, for those who don't know the city?
Berkeley is right outside of Oakland and San Francisco. It's in the East Bay, they would call it, the East Bay of the Bay Area.
And where in Berkeley is this Page Street address?
It is right near the Gilman District, which is Gilman is a freeway exit, and so it's right over there. It's the industrial area of Berkeley. Berkeley's not that big, but it's the industrial area.
Now, I passed through Gilman going on to that exit for another reason yesterday, and it looked like there were a lot of RVs parked in that area who I thought had been driven out of Berkeley. Is that also am I mistaken about that?
Well, they haven't been driven out necessarily. I don't want to say it, all of them. Some have gone to a safe campsite called Horizon. There's about 45 RVs there. And then many are along 8th and Harrison on one side of Gilman. And then on the other side, going south, are more RVs.
Huh. But you aren't situated next to an RV. You're in a different spot.
I am. We're in a, I would say it's a hybrid spot. So it's RVs and tents.
And how many folks are encamped there nearby with you?
I'm not really sure. We just moved here yesterday. So there was typically there are RVs in this area. There are very few tents. But the reason why we moved to this area was, now we can talk about the driving out. Mm-hmm. All of the encampments along the I-80 corridor have been swept. And then people have been swept in tents along 8th and Harrison. And so we made the decision to move our clients here. Most of them had decided to come here, and then some who didn't know where they were going to go. We've brought them with their former campmates, and so we all moved here. And the reason I moved here with them is because a rogue security guard was harassing and viciously verbally attacking a homeless woman. And so because we've had court cases and we've had preliminary injunctions and now it was time to move, there was really no other choice than to move in next to her and near another woman who moved from Berkeley to Emeryville yesterday during a sweep and then was told by the police that she couldn't be in Emeryville. We picked her up and brought her here. And so I moved here because I'm tired of the most vulnerable people being harassed and attacked. And if anyone shows up, then their attorney will come out and defend them.
And how many of your clients are in this area now?
I want to say about 10 to 12. I haven't actually done the count yet because it's been so busy. But I would say approximately 10 to 12.
Now, this is part of the encampment, Where Do We Go, correct?
Well, yes. The encampment, the folks in Where Do We Go were all a part of the encampments along the I-80 corridor. So it was made up of four encampments, which were the Gilman encampment, the downstairs, which is the I-80 underpass encampment, the Seabreeze encampment, which was the I-80 overpass encampment, as well as Ashby Shale Mound. And all of those individuals were a part of Where Do We Go.
And how many?
And so,
how many people did this constitute? Sorry.
In the beginning, we had approximately 150 to 160 people.
Hmm.
And this was over what kind of a period of time did these four encampments exist in the form that you described them in?
They started off small. I would say the first one being like probably 5 years ago, and then existed when I got involved in 2019. They were in place, and that's when we stopped the evictions for 2.5 years, and then they started up again.
What directed your attention to these encampments in 2019?
In 2019, there was a coordinated effort to evict people. At that time, you had Berkeley PD as well as Caltrans coming out to the encampment. So when someone would be evicted off of Caltrans land, the CHP would harass them and tell them to move on. And then as soon as they stepped onto the sidewalk, Berkeley PD would tell them they had to move as well. So there was really absolutely no place that they could go.
And Liberal Mayor Jesse Arguin had nothing to say about this?
Not at that time. At that time, they said at first there was no, you know, coordinated effort. However, I was there, and that's how this all started, was because people had all of their belongings taken. It was horrible, and there just was no place to go. And then eventually, City Council joined the table, and really, Caltrans was the one who came to the table with us and met with us and coordinated with us. And then their director changed, a lot of things changed, and now the sweep of the final encampment, Ashby Shell Mound, occurred.
And this was a relatively recent post-COVID sweep that happened after, because I understand you got an injunction that was lasting over several years in one form or another, but that sweeps then began anyway. And when did this be? When did? Tell me if I'm mistaken in any of these understandings.
Yes, yeah, so we never. I apologize. We never had an injunction initially, temporary or preliminary. We actually negotiated with Caltrans, and that's how the sweeps had started, stopped for 2.5 years. And then recently, about 6 months ago, when they started sweeping three encampments, that we brought a case arguing that under the ADA, because we went from 160 people down to, I would say, 25 people. And these are all just very rough estimates. And so the folks who were left, who hadn't been housed or moved, these were our most disabled. And so they couldn't go into congregate settings. They needed more accessible housing. But more importantly, they needed more time. Their disabilities required that they have extra time to access services. Sometimes when you have severe mental disability, and this could be, you know, PTSD, schizophrenia, et cetera, anxiety, it takes longer to organize your time, appointments, et cetera. You need assistance to get those things done. And so that's what we argued, and Judge Chen at the time granted us a six-month preliminary injunction.
This was for 25 people, more or less.
The first, I believe we had, I want to say, I can't remember in the first lawsuit, and then they got housed, and then the second one, I believe we had 11. But he recognized that there were other people on site. We were given like a weekend to amend the complaint, and so we went out and talked to people. So by that time, I think we had about, I want to say, and I could be wrong, it's like about 20 people. 11 known plaintiffs, and then those that we had mentioned to the judge who were evicted from Seabreeze and who ended up at Ashby Shell Mound.
Now, the 100-plus that were driven off after the Caltrans arrangement apparently was either violated or failed, what happened to them?
So they weren't driven off. off by Caltrans, I'm not going to say that, because we actually, for 2.5 years, we worked with Caltrans. I mean, we partnered their director, Tony Tavares of District 4, who's since moved on. He worked with us, and we would do cleanups, and we installed porta-potties. And so those folks were provided with services, and they were able to find housing, or they moved away, or, you know, different things happened. And then at the end, they started these evictions where people, some of them had not even been approached at all for services. Some of them simply couldn't access services because of their disabilities.
Mm-hmm. Now, I notice in reading this decision, well, Brent, maybe you should explain what happened on the legal front that... maybe it's not important because it's a little obscure. I was trying to pierce my way through the, I guess it's Judge Nelson's reversal of Judge Chen's essentially attempt to give your folks more time. Is that a proper understanding?
Yes. I'm sorry, there's a lot going on.
That's okay.
Outside. Yes. And so the idea was that that 6 months was too much time. But they were looking at a variety of factors, including Caltrans brought up the Sanchez decision, which was another decision involving property. And so they talked about, you know, how much time people should be given. And so, of course, we have some dispute about that decision, but when you're working on the ground with people, much of my time was just the preliminary order was expiring on April 30th. That was even before we went to the Ninth Circuit. So that didn't stop. So while the Ninth Circuit decision came down, we still knew that we had to move and that... that what was at issue was not to extend that preliminary injunction. Because Judge Chen, we requested another preliminary injunction, and that's when Judge Chen extended it for a month to April 30th.
And so
that makes sense.
You weren't looking for another one after that?
Yeah, so the original one was supposed to expire in March. I'm sorry, I should have explained that.
Mm-hmm.
The six-month one. And then we asked for 4 more months because... a few things, setbacks had occurred. One, the coordinated entry system in Alameda County was dismantled in November. That means everyone who was on that list for housing needed to be reassessed. So we had a few of our clients who were first on the list for housing, but who lost their place, and then because of a lot of administrative error, other people weren't reassessed, et cetera, which is key to housing. And then we had some other setbacks. And so... because of those things, we argued that people were getting services. We didn't want to displace an encampment. As you know, when you displace people and we can't find them, they have to start over with their services. And we worked so hard. We didn't want to lose that 6 months that we had gained to find accessible housing for these individuals. But the judge only gave us a month extra. And so April 30th was the expiration of the preliminary injunction. And so all the court was ruling on is the first preliminary injunction, which, you know, was really moot because it had already expired. I know it's very complicated and obscure, but for us, the focus for me was how do we get these folks who still, and this is something that I think homeless activists and the unsheltered feel, is that it doesn't matter what we do in court in terms of what's happening. The lawyers are working. I'm working. But what's happening on the street is daily survival, right? So there's these arguments happening in this, you know, in court, and then there's what are we going to do when the eviction comes? So it was a lot to work on.
So are you now without legal options in terms of extending this injunction still further in a legalistic way?
Yes, that would be moot because everyone has moved. So we're all at second and page. So that pattern, that issue has come to an end now because we're here at a different place. And that's why I'm here, because this was really the last place to go. And here, the women... being harassed. And I just wanted to make sure after these folks had been evicted from several encampments, right, on the most of them had come from the other encampments and moved to Ashby Shell Mound and then had to move again. And like I said, these are the folks who are suffering with severe disability, who were very vulnerable. They needed more than what court could provide at this time. They need an advocate. They need someone to stand up and speak for them and stop people from harassing, you know, at least be able to be a buffer. So that's what my plan is.
Can you describe kind of the physical surroundings of the place where these folks are currently living and where you are encamped yourself?
Sure. So we are on a city street. It's an industrial area. There's lots of businesses around. It's extremely loud at night. It really comes alive. I was surprised because during the day it's quite quiet. And at night, big trucks are coming through, lots of cars, lots of building. You can hear various machinery. And it's a street full of RVs and tents now. So it's a real hybrid. It's an isolated place. But still, the business owners don't want, like most places, they never want to see the unhoused.
What kind of businesses are there in this area? They mostly cater to tourists, cater to upper middle class people, cater to community folks in the neighborhood?
No, I don't know. I'm not as familiar, but it looks like metal shops, very industrial, commercial places, a lot of big trucks. Things like that. This is not a retail district. This is not a residential district. This is very industrial. So it looks like old steel mills and things like that.
Is there any sense of community among the homeless community or the unhoused community that's there, both in RVs, cars, and on the ground?
Absolutely. Just amazing. And when I can say that when I came, the RVs were very kind and brought chairs and helped us. We moved, you know, on the sidewalk. We brought a lot of tents and we brought people. And that could have been, as you know, like a lot of encampments are set communities. And so I'm very grateful that everyone here was very kind to us, you know, bringing these additional people here. So I feel like there is a very much a sense of community.
Is there any chance for any kind of, protective organization forming among the campers themselves?
I'm not sure. It's our, we just moved, right? And right now, I think people are getting used to their surroundings. My colleague, another attorney, brought coffee this morning and pastries. It's just, you know, waking up in a different home. You know, even though people are homeless, they still get used to where they're at, right? And it's become comfortable, and now they're not comfortable. So I would say I'm here to act as a buffer, and then in a few days, we'll start to talk about our next steps, right? Because I want to give them the opportunity to sort of relax. They've been packing for days. Like I said, some of them have been moving their stuff with bikes and bike trailers. I'll call the city while they rest, you know?
Mm-hmm. And how many, I was going to say, this is your first camping out experience, or you've done this before?
I've done this before. I did this at the beginning of Where Do We Go, Berkeley. So after those coordinated evictions, I moved into the Seabreeze encampment for the same reason, because many people at that time didn't have the resources to call quickly when Caltrans would arrive. So I moved in so that I do have resources. And so I'm not going to say that would be demeaning others to try to act like, oh, I moved in, so I'm unhoused too, you know. But I did come in to live here because I know that I could call people faster. And in this case, you know, everybody was so weary. Once again, it was that same dire situation where it was like, I'll put up a tent because you're not going to mess with my client. You're not going to yell at her or threaten her. I could be here as a buffer because she's exhausted and she's tired and she's disabled and she's moved many times. And so that's why I came here, was because of the gravity.
Mm-hmm. And again, going back to your earlier support and your earlier encampment, how long did you stay?
I was there, the first time I stayed a little over a week, and then I went back. I can't remember if I stayed several days. I know I kept a tent. One of the residents kept my tent. So I would stay on and off, like a day here or a couple days there, depending on what we were being threatened with. And then once I felt that everyone, that threat had passed, then I moved out of the encampment. But I always had my tent there.
Indeed. What was the effect of your staying in the prior instance? I mean, was there an abrupt change in the behavior of the harassment? I guess I should ask, what kind of threat were the folks facing on this first encampment experience you had?
So the threat was eviction. And so the first time, three of us refused to move, or actually four. It was two elderly women and one young woman whose partner had been killed by a train. Two gentlemen at that time had been killed by an Amtrak train here in Berkeley. Or maybe it was Union Pacific, I can't remember. But we refused to move when Caltrans came, and then they left. And then the entire encampment, both upstairs and downstairs, made a decision that they just weren't going to move.
And we'll be checking in on the consequences of that decision after this musical break.
I am a roving rambler, a fitter to me trade. I can fix you anything, a camshaft to a spade. I can fix a dodgy gearbox, mend a broken tread, decoke a Leyland engine while I'm standing on me head. So shift, boy, shift, do the job and draw your pay. When this job is finished, I'll be moving on me way. I'll clean me tools and wrap them in a pair of oily jeans. You'll always find me working where you find the big machines. I've worked in far-off places since I left the coaly time. I work among the heavies and I wear a roving sign. I keep the tractors on the job, I turn it up the soil. I've followed me nose around the world, but the smell of diesel oil. So shift, boy, shift, do the job and draw your pay. When this job is finished, I'll be moving on my way. You'll find me where the tractors are, on roads and hydro schemes, playing the lousy nursemaid to a pack of big machines.
And so I was a part of that. So when Caltrans came, I called activists, and I sat with, at that time I wasn't a lawyer, and I was just an activist, and I hadn't passed the bar yet. And so I sat with them, and we just didn't move. When Caltrans came, we started picking up garbage, but we didn't get up and move things. And then Caltrans left. And so after that, we wrote an open letter to the mayor and to the director of Caltrans. And the director of Caltrans met with residents, and they told their stories. And that's when we started to work together to create a more humane way to solve the homelessness problem by working with resource providers, by putting in porta potties, by cleaning up the trash and having trash pickup. So it was really a solutions focused refusal.
I guess I've asked you this before. It's a little puzzling to me. You said most of the folks who were who were not so much swept away but moved away or got alternate housing. My impression has been that the crisis for unhoused folks has increased, not diminished in the last 2 years, although there have been massive amounts of money supposedly made available. What's your sense of that, since you see, you know, you're keeping an eye? Can you hear me?
Yes, I can. I'm sorry.
I can. There's no problem. I have no problem with the dog. Go ahead.
Oh, okay. No. Oh, sorry. Someone's helping me with my dog. He's a little under the weather. Uh-huh. So I think the issue, your question is, have I seen that increase with homelessness?
Yeah, because I really am wondering why Caltrans' perspective changed and why you were... Was there actually an emergency, an exigent situation that required forcing people to move from where they were previously?
We don't believe so. One of the encampments was swept because there was a fire. But that was one that could have been mitigated. Fire is always an issue in homeless encampments, right? And we did try to mitigate that with fire extinguishers, et cetera. But for one of the encampments, the extinction circumstance, I believe, was real estate development. And the other was aesthetics. The Seabreeze encampment, everyone would see that. It was across from the Seabreeze Cafe, and so the city would get a lot of complaints. And I believe that... after COVID, they decided to start evicting these encampments and tried to say that there were critical situations, but they had been in existence for a long time. They'd become very organized and centralized with services. So that's why, and we were so close, like I said, to getting everyone housed. So I don't believe that there was anything really serious, just the end of COVID and real estate development and aesthetics, you know. Poverty is ugly. It's not pretty. Mm-hmm. And it's not supposed to be. And a lot of people who are housed and leaders don't like the look of it. It makes them uncomfortable, as it should.
Was most of the housing, first of all, are we talking about cheesy shelter space, or are we talking about real long-term housing when you talk about housing?
I was talking about real estate. Like one of the encampments, market rate housing went up. They say it's affordable, but they only have like 6 to 8 units that are affordable. So because of that development, the homeless individuals got swept. It wasn't the availability of housing or because affordable housing was being built. Mm-hmm. It's the development of land that was the reason why people had to move.
I understand that, but I guess my question is, because of those, of the many people who have, you said, gotten other accommodations and been helped with housing, has that been mostly inside Berkeley, outside Berkeley? Has it been mostly short-term shelter, or has it been long-term, affordable, not affordable is a bad word, you know, housing that's really affordable, not this crap that they use to describe housing. It's affordable to upper middle class people sometimes. So
I would say it's a little bit of everything. COVID actually brought in a lot of FEMA money. So the Project Room Key hotels, I feel like, created a model that was workable. Because of the FEMA money, people were moved into hotels where there were housing navigators and case managers who helped to get them into temporary supportive housing and then into permanent housing with a voucher, subsidized housing. And so we saw much more housing of people during COVID in the Project Room Key hotels than before.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of folks have moved into apartments, which is wonderful. And so I really believe that that model during COVID should continue. The difficulty is now with COVID over, the FEMA funding is evaporating. So Berkeley, for example, applied for a grant, but that money is that $4.7 billion to do something similar to the Project Room Key Hotel is earmarked only for the eviction of homeless residents at People's Park and for the eventual closure of a shelter. So no one else could take advantage of those opportunities when money's earmarked like that.
Mm-hmm. Was most of the housing, so-called housing, found inside Berkeley? This is question number one. And question number two is most of the Project Room Key and House Key housing shutting down now?
It is, but it's transitioning. So cities and counties are turning the hotels into either permanent supportive housing, temporary supportive housing, or as in the case of Berkeley, the roadway, which was our Project Room Key Hotel, is turning into temporary supportive housing for those at People's Park. People are getting housed in Berkeley, but very few. I tend to see more vouchers being given for places like Alameda, Hayward, Oakland, and even further out. Mm-hmm. So in Berkeley, it's very hard to find housing where you're at.
Is there still a determination on the a part of people who are unhoused in Berkeley and approached by the police to move to assert so-called Martin versus Boise rights, or is that gone by the board?
I don't understand your question. Could you repeat that? I'm sorry.
No, that's fine. In other words, you're familiar with the Martin versus Boise decision, obviously.
Yes.
So that, of course, for listeners, is the decision that says unless you can provide housing or shelter, you cannot criminalize someone who's outside in terms of giving them things like camping tickets, presumably putting them in a position where they can say, come back when you've got something to show me that's really, you know, some really accessible housing that I, let's say, as a disabled person can use. Are people resisting that in Berkeley, or is it only in this? What sounds like, I'm wondering if it's a rare case of your coming in to be supportive. I guess I should ask, were you called in by your clients to say, help, you know, and did you say right on, or did you see this and just and come in to volunteer? This most recent chapter here.
We've been with them from the beginning. And so as the eviction started, things were going really, you know, they weren't being threatened. And so myself and the other legal team members were not as involved. But then as the notices came out, the threats of notices came out, that's when we got involved. And Martin v. Boise, like you said, applies to the criminalization of homelessness, some sort of citation being issued. In this case, folks weren't issued citations. It was the threat of this where the harm would be that they would be placed in a more dangerous position and that they were given housing, but that housing was not accessible.
And in what sense, if you care to comment on this, was it not accessible?
Well, for example, you would have people with severe trauma and disability who could not stay in congregate shelters. It would literally affect their disability. You know, PTSD is not a memory. It's a reliving of an incredible traumatic experience. And so these group settings were just unable to accommodate people who had terrible trauma.
Now, did you have to prove any of these disabilities, or was there sort of a good faith understanding with Caltrain authorities that, you know, this was a situation that was real and that initially sort of smoothed the way for this kind of understanding that you had over the last few years? And if that's the case, why do you feel now that it's no longer in force? Or is it? I mean, I don't know.
So in this case, I'm sorry, I'm trying to do a few. It's getting a little crazier. In this case, with any time you in this particular lawsuit, normally you wouldn't get experts and whatnot until you start to get ready for trial during discovery. At the preliminary stage, we did tell the court about the disabilities that our clients had and that they had been, some had been diagnosed with them, most had been diagnosed logo, right? Many times people who are homeless don't see the doctor, right? They're not going to have those recent records. But we did have a psychologist look over their declarations and what they had said about their previous disabilities, and agreed that a congregate shelter was not accessible for them. You know, trial process is long, and getting that type of evidence, we weren't at that stage yet, but we provided what we needed to based on the law at this stage. But still, what our case was about was what was a reasonable accommodation under the American with Disabilities Act, and we were given 6 months, and the Ninth Circuit said 6 months was too much. But by that time, our preliminary injunction had expired, and now we're where we're at, getting people, these last folks, into accessible housing, safe housing, a place where they're not going to be harassed on the street, not in such a vicious way by someone who's like a rogue security guard. We don't even know yet. We'll see when he comes back. Everyone talks about this person, comes through and terrorizes them.
Folks have their cameras ready? Or?
Yes, they've had pictures of them, but, you know, that's what I'm waiting to meet, whomever this is, because we've had many reports of this person and then other business owners, but it's just to be here to say, you know what, there's nowhere for them to go. We're working with the city, and, you know, we've done everything we can in court, and now we're here, and if the city can provide us with a safe place for my clients to go, we'll go. As long as it's, you know, they're safe and they feel safe and they're not going to be, you know, verbally assaulted.
And for those folks who want to follow this, your continuing struggle here, and their continuing struggle, I should say, where can they go online to keep abreast of events, be supportive, look in, that sort of thing?
So where do we go, Berkeley? If they look that up on Google, where do we go, Berkeley has turned into the organization that we founded, that's turned into 501c3 nonprofit. It's run by Ian Rogers, and they can go to that website to find out more about what Where Do We Go Berkeley is doing and how folks are being helped. I work very closely with them since we started the organization back when I wasn't practicing law, but now I'm with the East Bay Community Law Center, and so I work very closely so they can get updates from there, or follow us, like I said, at East Bay Community Law Center. There'll be updates on their social media channels.
Mm-hmm. And has your experience as a lawyer, do you think, impacted your perspective on this?
It's added more remedies, but it's allowed me to advocate, you know, legally, but many times when you're helping those who are unhoused, you have to look for many alternatives to solve problems of the most vulnerable on the street, to protect them, because the law may not always be the answer, right? It can help you, but sometimes, you know, it may not go your way, and the people on the streets are still suffering. They're still being harassed. They're still being swept. So I think being a lawyer has helped me to advocate more and provide stronger advocacy. But you always have to be adaptable and flexible to defend your clients in the best way possible, whatever that may be.
Mm-hmm. Sure. What's your sense of the situation for folks outside in Berkeley coming out of COVID, with the shelter in place essentially gone and Martin versus Boise perhaps largely ignored? What's your general sense of how Berkeley authorities are responding? Is it simply sort of now an engine to facilitate real estate developers and conservative residents, or do you see something else happening?
There are fewer places for homeless individuals to exist. And I think that that is not just a Berkeley problem. That's a California problem. And that because of COVID, homeless populations are increasing. People are more transient, and I think that we're going to have to really come up with more realistic solutions. And it's not just going to be a shelter opening here and there. It has to be people who work with these populations and do needs assessments and develop programs that are more accessible for vulnerable populations. And we're seeing that in Berkeley, that, you know, there's just fewer places to go. And this is an example of that. So everyone came here because there is really nowhere else to go. If you go downtown, there's sidewalk ordinances. You know, you can't be in residential areas, of course. And homeless individuals don't want to be. They're human. They want to be respected. You know, these places are out of the way. But there's just nowhere to go. So we have to come up with better solutions working with city leaders. We need more pressure. And it's going to get worse before it gets better. I hate to be cliche, but...
Much connection with Oakland unhoused folks in their encampments, which I take it are larger and more extensive.
So I've been working with residents at Wood Street and advocates there, and it's the same thing. Caltrans is going in and starting to do sweeps. People are being moved. It's the same argument. It's that it's, you know, unsafe, it's dangerous, but poverty is unsafe and dangerous. You can't just keep pushing people to different places and not expect the same thing to happen, right? Albert Einstein said that's insanity. And so I think we're going to see more, much larger evictions and much more displacement. What I've noticed in Oakland when I go to those encampments is the lack of services. In Berkeley, I see more services, and it's still very difficult to get people housed. A lot of unhoused folks in Oakland don't get any direct outreach from service providers. And so they haven't even started those processes. They get moved with, you know, nothing. And it could be as simple as an EBT card, getting food stamps or cash aid. You know, that helps. Anything helps to start the ball rolling for housing. And I don't see a lot of that in Oakland at all. The people I meet, I always ask them, has anyone come out to talk to you? And they always say no, unfortunately.
Are there any large encampments left in Berkeley?
Second and Page.
Right on.
Care There is still there.
People's Park for the moment?
For the moment. That's going to close in June. They're remodeling the roadway to move all of those folks inside. Because they're gonna raise the park and build student housing.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Well, I'm running down, but I'm sure there's a lot I haven't asked. Is there anything that you would like to be asked that you would like to comment on?
Yeah, I feel like this was just really thorough, and I appreciate you taking the time to talk to us. And I will definitely keep people posted. This is, you know, quickly changing, and I'm just, you know, you've always been with us from the beginning since we started Where Do We Go Berkeley, and so I'm so grateful to be on your show and to be able to share the stories of these incredible people, my clients, who are just so amazing and resilient despite the horrendous things that are put on them just because maybe they don't have enough money or because they have a disability. Things like that. So I just really appreciate the support of your show and of all your listeners. It means a lot to us out here.
Well, I don't know how many listeners I have, but I'm glad we're documenting this, because although I'm sure you're documenting it in many other places. Does KPFA give you much coverage or not?
Poor Magazine, the Avid Radio Show on KPFA. Mm-hmm. And so... they were out here today actually talking to us. They've always been extremely supportive since the beginning. I don't know about KPFA, you know, regular reporters. We have had coverage. But, yeah, maybe things will change again. We were fortunately, no one was covering us because things were going so well. And that's good.
Indeed. Until the axe falls, of course.
And it's fallen, yes.
Well, you sound in great spirits, and I'm impressed. So I will probably get back to you and find out what's going on to follow the continuing saga, and get back to me if you want. If you feel there's something you want me to put out one way or another, and I will suggest that people check out where do we go Berkeley to see what's cooking there. Just check on your browser, any listeners, to check in on what's happening with the folks that Andre Hansen is spending time with here and camping out with and trying to stand up for.
Yes.
Yeah.
Thank you so much.
Okay. You too.
Okay. Have a great day.
You too.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
And I haven't really been able to get good updated information in the last few times I've looked at the Where Do We Go Berkeley website and Facebook page. I think I couldn't find a website, just a Facebook page. But keep checking, folks. I mean, who knows? And I will also be trying to reach Andrea, as I have today, without success, by phone to get an update, because this is a week-old account that you just heard. So now we're going to hear some music from what we were listening to on Sunday, if you were following the show then, from the new Brighton Gazette by Ewan McCall and Peggy Seeger. And the last song you heard was called The Fitter's Song. I guess that's a worker in... probably fitters all over the place in the United States if I only knew what the term meant. But with the use of the Internet, I can tell you a fitter, according to this, is a person who fits a garment or a person who is skilled in the assembly and adjustment of machinery, especially of a specified sort. And I think it's that building definition, that machinery definition we're talking about. Here's another one called the Exile Song, again by Ewan McCall.
Just a note, for time is short, dear. Hard the work and long the day, but my heart is with you, Mary. Though I'm many a mile away, kiss the children for me, Mary. Do not let them pine or grieve. Tell them how I'm working for them, why our home I had to leave. Building dams, airfields and factories, moving concrete by the load. I'll be with you in October, when I'm finished on the road.
So next up we have an interview with Keith McHenry, which recorded this afternoon by phone, kind of trying to get an update, as I usually do, on life on the ground, which tends to then skip around the world and get on to broader topics, which is okay with me, because I think it touches things we haven't really touched much before. Going into masking, war in the Ukraine, and so forth, but also wandering through homeless information around the meal at the town clock, the benchlands, and so forth. So let's listen in.
It's May 12th, and it's around 2:15 or thereabouts. Well, maybe a little less, but I'm on the line with Keith McHenry, who's a notable aficionado and a worker with, as well as co-founder of Food Not Bombs.
Yes, that's right.
And Keith, you're working on your new book.
Andrea McHenry's birthday. So everybody wish her a happy birthday.
Whose birthday?
Andrea McHenry.
Oh, Andrea, the your former consort.
It's her big day. She's 65 today.
My goodness. Well, you had your mother had a birthing day for you too recently, right?
Yeah, that was last week. I'm sorry.
Now, did you have a fun party? Did the police arrest you as a traditional event?
No, what we had was somebody steal all of our belongings.
Oh, that's good. Well, I knew something had to be happening, you know.
Yeah, so that was fun. Yeah.
That's right. I think I remember you mentioning that to me, although I don't know if it was mentioned in a netcast. I suppose I should turn to something that's of more moment to folks who are poor, homeless, or sympathetic to those kinds. What's going on with the meal at the town clock, given the, well, I guess there was a city council meeting 2 days ago which afforded a lot of positions for enforcement and for getting more money for the city council and for making more plans for more shelter that doesn't currently exist. Well, what's going on the ground, Keith?
People looking for food. That's definitely one thing. It's been real windy, so we've had, like, you know, it's been a real drag serving food in this wind. But and people, I've got a lot of requests for tents, and I had requests for tents and sleeping bags today. So I had one tent with me, so that was good. But I didn't have any. Woman just lost everything, like, this morning, so I didn't have chance to help out with that.
From the Benchlands or from somewhere else?
I don't know where she was sleeping, but she, you know, she lost everything, whatever it was, and requested things for, you know, for that purpose, like a tent and a sleeping bag, which is really tragic. So there was that. And then I got an email from Tony, the head of the Parks Department, wanting to meet about the rodents and complaints from the people that yell obscenities at us when we serve food at the town clock.
Well, that's wrong. It's wrong. Why are you serving food at the town clock when you could be not serving food at the town clock?
Yeah, it's really funny. And then I was just, you know, thinking, oh, my God, I think people that are thoughtful will realize that us serving food for 750 days during a pandemic was probably a good thing. Otherwise, that would have been 750 days of some pretty angry, hungry people that probably would stop at nothing to get food. And therefore, our little village would be not so positive of a place for hedge funds to invest in. So they should be giving us a free luxury condo.
There you go. Maybe an adjacent luxury condo. Then you could
a stainless steel kitchen across the street in the abandoned White House Bank.
Is it abandoned? I thought it was actually still operational. I see people going in and out of that bank.
No, that's just where the people that work actually now at the Santa Cruz County Bank around the corner have lunch and keep their stuff and park. They don't actually bank there anymore. That bank got bought.
Interesting.
Yeah, it's just really an empty bank, essentially.
So did your problems with the Mexican restaurant across the street get resolved?
It seems like it has, yeah. I've been going in and getting my horchata and talking to them. They don't seem to be, and it seems super crowded and everything, and there's no, you know, when I go there at lunch, and yeah, I don't think there's much going on there. It's just that Thomas and Sammy got into a fist fight that he ended up moving across the street towards there. So their fights have been more at the town clock the last couple of days, so that's been good.
Have you thought of charging admission?
For the fun of it? Yeah, we should have. I should start gambling. I should run like numbers or something. Who's going to beat up who successfully?
Is this a function?
Round one, round two.
What do you make of this? Is there increased tension among homeless folks generally? Is this just a sort of an isolated instance? What's your take on this?
Well, Thomas and Sammy have been fighting each other. It's my understanding they started fighting each other in elementary school, and now they're young adults and they're still fighting each other. So and there's a few people like that that have problems in either middle school or elementary school that just still have problems as adults with whoever it was they had problems with back then. So that's my understanding. When they started fighting each other, but it wasn't in public school.
I got you. Now they're just doing it in public, right?
Yeah, now they're just in public, yeah. And it's kind of interesting because a lot of the conflicts are decades old that play out at our place. Now, the thing that's been really good is that there's been when we were at Lot 27, there was a couple of people trying to run a methamphetamine business near there. And so they had to be real violent to keep people from stealing their money and their product. But now, so that's not happening. That's reduced a lot of the problems. So, no one wants to be openly.
So regarding methamphetamine, the business, Brent Adams seems to feel, and I think maybe Jeremy Leonard agrees with him, although I'm not sure, I've never seen this myself, that there's some kind of gang cartel operating in the benchlands. What's your take on that?
Yeah, I think there are definitely a number of gangs that are not in the benchlands, and I have an impression from talking to people who are associated with these gangs that, in part, the gangs that were being somehow ignored over by Taco Bell and the liquor store over there during the let's have all the drugs be over there gentrification program have now moved over to the benchland since now the Pacific and Laurel has been being gentrified, and there's no reason to be for the state to be running a drug operation there anymore. So I think it's just moved over to the benchlands, and to my understanding too, there is another operation occurring kind of more by the wharf, and I'm not sure why the authorities want the drugs to be sold by the wharf, but it might be for the purpose of. It's not clear. But usually the government sells heroin, cocaine, and meth and fentanyl and shit where they want the economy to go down to drive down land prices so that the hedge funds can come in and scoop it up at a cheaper price.
Now, this is certainly quite plausible. This is a plausible theory, Keith, but have you ever seen any real documentation that this is the case in Santa Cruz?
Well, I do notice that the area that there's been drug dealing and plainclothes cops dealing, around the liquor store and the Taco Bell for a long time. Then suddenly I'm over there now, because I go over there and get stuff, and there's none of that's happening anymore. So, but there is a luxury condo, two luxury condos and a luxury hotel project happening. So that's like kind of what happened in 8th Street, It's like the city started selling crack at the corner, and then they started like this whole fencing operation out of a local, or the police set up an antique store and then paid full price for anything stolen. And then once they pissed everybody off and the thing got real hardcore and the prices of real estate went down, then they miraculously busted that fencing operation and then all that stopped. And this seems to be, and there's a good book on this. It was written about Nettler, the chief of police, and his use of that to manipulate events in the Haight-Ashbury back in the 60s, and his creation of the Death of Hippie, which was a heroin program that the SFPD was running. And then, and then, of course, my grandfather was very open about.
What about what's the name of that book, Keith, that you're mentioning?
Oh God, I know it's some boring name, like police practices during the summer of love.
And the name of the author again?
It was about the chief of police and his drug operation there, and I forget it was a very detailed account of how we did it, but I forget, it was like a boring, it was basically like a publishing of somebody's doctoral thesis, so it wasn't like the most impressive book. But I remember back in the time, because his daughter was right-wing, county supervisor in San Francisco, and she only survived, I think, she was only in office during the first year or two of the arrest of the Bronx. Then she just sort of disappeared off into nowhere.
Now, getting back to Santa Cruz, I know that you have taken a somewhat different view, for example, of the COVID situation, its legitimacy, its seriousness, and you've been somewhat skeptical, for example, although you've pursued maintaining social distances and suggesting unmasking when it became a city requirement. But you've also had some problems with some places, like you couldn't get into a Joe Schultz event because it was masking, required masks, which you felt, and maybe even proof of vaccination, and you're not a fan of vaccinations. Correct me if I'm giving out any misinformation, or shut me up if I'm saying too much about your.
No, well, I think it's been, most of studies show masks are total bullshit, but that's, but I mean, if people want to look cool in their mask, it's cool. You can do that. I have no problem with that. Probably the N95 might be slightly effective.
I guess what I'm trying to get to.
But anyway, I think it's dumb that you have to have masks to do anything, but I would not go into places just because of masks, but I definitely will, under no circumstances, get a COVID vaccine, and under no circumstances will I enter any place that requires that or give them any money for any reason.
Now, what is your source for this, for those who are, shall we say, sedulous followers of vaccination, like myself, somewhat? I mean, I haven't taken the 48th booster or anything of that sort, but, you know, I've had a number of the vaccines. Haven't noticed any particularly bad effects, but on the other hand, I haven't, I've gotten some, usual illnesses that have kind of come and gone, and wondered if I've been COVID, a recipient. But if you were to recommend to someone a particular basis, and you said, I think you've told me that a lot of your medical expertise on this, so to speak, or at least your information, is based on your conversations with trusted medical colleagues that you know. But if you were to recommend to someone to research this area and perhaps come up with the same conclusions you have, what would you say?
I would actually read all of the documents that have been released by Pfizer since the litigation in Irvine, California, that forced the release of nearly 100,000 pages. I think it's pretty definitive. You read that. What little I have read of that, will 100% guarantee that you would under no circumstances ever get a vaccine. If you just read through their trial data and everything like that. So that would be the most educational place to get information. But predating that, because that's only 2 months that's been released. First there was a few thousand pages, and then the night that the Alito's leaked document on Roe v. Wade came out, Pfizer was wisely dumped 80,000 pages to make sure that no one paid attention. So I think that the Pfizer's own data and Walgreens' data, their reports, I think pretty much is a slam dunk on why it would be not necessarily wise to get vaccines unless you are very, very old and susceptible to potential problems of COVID. So I've had COVID 3 times, and then I moved 2 shipping containers during the last time. I was Omicron. It was like nothing, I'm more miserable normally just from my police beating from April 29th, 1992 than I was from Omicron. Delta was nasty, and I think if I were like 90 years old and in bad health, it could have taken me out for sure. Now, whether a vaccine would have helped or not, this is unclear.
what it potentially could have. And I think that the original scientists that were discussing, like the people that, there was a huge number of thousands of actual doctors and scientists in this field that signed a document encouraging medical professionals to isolate seniors and to provide early treatment. And if a vaccine was found to be safe, that group should potentially get vaccinated. But they were, and I think we're seeing now that the crisis of vaccinating everybody is a problem. But then the original person who I spoke to, the scientists having an impression that when NPR runs every story about COVID and vaccines and their known, propaganda wing of the state, that became pretty suspicious. But then when Dr. Shannon Murray, who's been a friend of mine for decades.
And back to Keith and Dr. Shannon Murray and the general perspective he has in a moment. First, here's a song which lightens things up perhaps a little bit.
There's no cause for alarm, there's really no cause for alarm. It's merely cheap being cheap for sensible people. No, it can't do any harm. The facts have been collated and the figures calculated and the risks evaluated and the findings validated and our experts vindicated, but they clearly demonstrated that the dangers to the public have been much exaggerated. So stay cool and stay calm, for there is no cause for alarm. First, we'd like to put an end to this unfounded speculation concerning the emission of low-level radiation. Now, this is just routine. Indeed, the dose is well below the maximum permissible laid down by those who know. The facts, as far as we can ascertain them, clearly show the risks are scientifically acceptable. And so, we know there's no cause for alarm, there's really no cause for alarm. It's clearly safe, clean and cheap, all sensible people. No, it can't do any harm. The facts have been collated and the figures calculated and the risks evaluated and the findings validated and our risk was vindicated, but they clearly demonstrated that the dangers to the public have been much exaggerated. So stay cool and stay calm, for there is no cause for alarm. Now, if you've worked yourself into a state of high emotion about the waste plutonium discharge into the ocean, you should not be upset by such unscientific chatter. You far more chance of being scratched to death by your peccata. Analysis has shown a little radioactive matter just makes the water warmer, so the fish are getting fatter. So there's no cause for alarm, there's really no cause for alarm. It's clearly safe, clean and cheap for sensible people. No, it can't do any harm. The facts have been collated and the figures calculated and the risks evaluated and the findings validated and our rate was vindicated, but they clearly demonstrated that the dangers to the public have been much exaggerated. So stay cool and stay calm, for there is no cause for alarm. Disquiet has been voiced about our foolproof cooling system because of cracks which have occurred and sometimes we have missed them. The cracks are slight and superficial, hardly worth a mention, although of course we're giving them our most expert attention. The calculations prove there is no cause for apprehension, for these are far too complex for the layman's comprehension. So there's no cause for alarm, there's really no cause for alarm. It's clearly safe, clean and cheap for sensible people. No, it can't do any harm. The facts have been collated and the figures calculated and the risks evaluated and the findings validated and our experts vindicated, but they clearly demonstrated that the dangers to the public have been much exaggerated. So stay cool and stay
know you'd like to ask about those missing fewer rods. Well, first of all, let's make it clear we don't claim to be gods. We took each rod and scrupulously chopped it up and canned it, and numbered it most carefully, and then just as we planned it, we put it in the cooling pond. But when we went to land it, it wasn't there at all. We simply cannot understand it. But there's no cause for alarm, there's really no cause for alarm. It's clearly taken in cheap old sensible people. No, it can't do any harm. The facts have been collated and the figures calculated and the risks evaluated and the findings validated and the rest was vindicated, but they clearly demonstrated that the dangers to the public have been much exaggerated. Stay cool, stay calm, for there is no cause for alarm. We're very often asked about disposal of the waste. Indeed, this is a problem, and of course it's being faced. We're working on it daily with resource and dedication, examining a process which we call vitrification, methodically testing every granite rock formation, investigating ocean beds and solar exploration. We're working in the field of dematerial developments in, but at last we feel we're in a breakthrough situation. For the final solutions in the process of creation. So there's no cause for alarm, there's really no cause for alarm. It's clearly taken from cheap balls, sensible people. No, it can't do any harm. The facts have been collected and the figures calculated and the risks evaluated and the findings validated and the risks have been vindicated, but they clearly demonstrated that the dangers to the public have been much exaggerated. So stay cool and stay calm, for there is no cause for alarm.
And that was Leon Russellson in his album, I Didn't Mean It, and of course, No Cause for Alarm.
Whose partner was my best friend, Carl Chasky, came to meet with us here in Santa Cruz to outline that this was not safe yet and potentially could never be safe, and that in trials that she worked on the Moderna vaccine at NIH under Dr. Fauci for I think 4 years, maybe a little longer, and they were they could not get successful the vaccines to actually protect the animals that they're testing. They're having a real problem with that, with roughly of the 80% of the vaccinated animals coming down with and dying of SARS-CoV-1 when they're exposed to it. So their belief was, or her belief was, and other scientists in her teams, that this was not ready yet. It may never be ready. It may never be safe. And now we can see in the VAERS, so Pfizer says that 1,223 individuals died from the vaccine in their trials, but they refused to release that the number of people vaccinated was redacted, and so we don't know what that percentage is. But typically when a vaccine before the COVID vaccines were released, if there was even 5 deaths, they would halt production and try to figure out what went wrong, and then if they could solve the problem, then reintroduce it. But this number that they're presenting today of 1 million people dying of COVID, there's a lot of evidence that that's an extremely exaggerated number, including the head of the CDC said that they were going to re-audit, just like Santa Clara County did an audit and found that their numbers were actually lower by 20% of people who died of COVID. Now, many people had COVID and died of other things, mostly, you know, other related health crises that certainly would be, you know, from my experience of having COVID, you know, if you had very big problems with heart, your heart, you know, like heart attack
or something like that. I can see the stress of it would could tip you over the edge to death. So I can, you know, we were just essentially lied to for massive profits, and of course, and for social control. But I think the biggest issue is not so much the actual vaccine, but the civil liberties issues that we can see are happening, like massive deplatforming and shutting down of PayPal accounts, and you know, and essentially you denying there to be a public debate about these issues amongst scientists. That, you know, in fact, my friend Dr. Shannon Murray was not using her name until probably a year and a half into the crisis, because none of the people that actually knew how these things worked want, you know, basically they kind of stopped working and went underground and tried to conceal their location and so on for fear of reprisal.
Well, you know, I remember you were not too eager to have your own position of the criticism of the masking. I don't know about the social distancing, but the vaccinations generally, and the COVID vaccination in particular, you didn't really want to, because of the sort of massive, some would say education, others would say propaganda campaign in the Santa Cruz community. At what point did you become more open about your beliefs on this?
Well, once I was first of all, I was kind of quiet when I wasn't. When I was told I had to have proof of vaccination to see the show on Joel Schultz, then I went to my favorite restaurant or, you know, coffee shop that I went to frequently, and they demanded proof of vaccination.
Tabby Cat, by the way, is, I've been told at the Huff meeting today, is no longer requiring that or even requiring masks, so they still have signs up.
Oh, cool. Well, that's good. I would go back as long as they don't ask you any questions.
Mm-hmm.
And then you couldn't go to concerts, you know, you couldn't go to Moe's, you couldn't go to, you know, like, there's tons of events I would have liked to have gone to, you weren't allowed to go to. And it's a segregation, and it's not based on science. And not, we can see, you know, we were told that you get you to, you know, I recall, and I know a lot of people who are pro-vax don't want to remember this, but we were told at the beginning that you'd get these two shots and then you would do, and it would be you were done, and that was heavily implied, and that there was a 2-week lockdown with work and so on, and that we were told overtly that if you were vaccinated, the COVID wouldn't spread, that you wouldn't have to be hospitalized, and you wouldn't get sick, and none of those things turn out to be true. I mean, that's just self-evident in wandering around in the United States meeting normal people and talking to them, because we all know now, you know, I think I don't know if there was somebody that just died in Santa Cruz County, and I don't know any of the details of that, of COVID apparently, but I just saw a passing headline.
COVID related, I think it was, yeah.
Yeah, and the person before that was fully vaccinated. So, the month before. So none of that, you know, so we were lied to, clearly, you know, because it would be very hard, you know, maybe somebody out there thinks that every single person that was fully vaccinated has never gotten COVID as a result, or, and never gave COVID to anybody else as a result. But I don't think that, you know, and I also, the other thing that was, so it was that being denied to show up. Then the final one, which just to end that logic, was, and which why I wrote a paper about it, an essay on it, was people were trying to get me to go to a new, you know, progressive coalition to resist, like, the downtown development and things like that, which I'm all in support of joining such a coalition, but you had to have proof of vaccination to participate. And it's like, okay, that was the final straw. I'm not going to. And the thing is that, you know, before COVID, you know, I've been organizing against capitalism and corporate power now since the, at least like about 1970.
71, 72. And I was involved in attending protests against the European Union and the Euro. I was at the founding convention of the People's Global Agenda in Geneva, Switzerland to protest the WTO. I helped organize the protests in Seattle against the WTO, also in Genoa and in Cancun. I participated in, also organized against at the biotech conference. We had the Funa Bombs gathering in Philadelphia during that and organized against that. I've been organizing with the Organic Consumer Association and Ronnie Cummings and Alexa and all them against GMO, Monsanto GMO crops. I've been doing a lot of stuff with Vandana Shiva over the decades.
And therefore what?
And so therefore, once we got to COVID, I anticipated that the left would also continue to protest, Donald Trump, for example, Operation Warp Speed, the military component of that, DARPA.
Remind us what Operation Warp Speed was.
That was the rushing out of the Moderna, Pfizer, and J&J vaccines. And that was the Trump administration doing that. Mm-hmm. And then, and we were against Big Pharma and its exploitative behaviors and that kind of corporate power of that nature. I've been doing that forever. And then today what we're facing is because of the use of COVID lockdowns, which is impoverished expanses of the economy and all kinds of other economic and political repercussions. It also is ushering in this kind of effort to go to a central bank digital currency and more invasion of privacy and censorship, the massive censorship. So the left always was against censorship. They were against infringements on your civil liberties, and they were against corporate profiteering and exploitation, and we also had policies against military industrial complex. But on March 14th, 2020, the left abandoned that, and you get intimidated if you were advocating those same policies. That I think was a shame. But I decided, well, it's such bullshit that I'm just going to start speaking out on it. Because, we got that, I think, is the civil liberties issue now. Because even the increase in homelessness in the United States is directly connected to policies of shutting down, small businesses, but allowing